It's the Lansing Armstrong edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, De-Extinction, the Doe of Doha, Earth Busts a Gamma Ray, and Lance Armstrong and Professional Doping. Let's begin episode 197.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross-sort politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of dark stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know it all.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. Ethan, you
yes.
must be happy.
I'm very happy. Why?
Hockey's back.
Oh, yes. I love hockey.
Yes. So, what conspiracy theory has been revolving around hockey? Anything?
There is, of course, the conspiracy that Gary Bettman, league commissioner, is trying to destroy Canadian values by moving Canadian teams into worthless American markets.
Are they worthless markets because they're American, or are they worthless just because nobody there likes hockey?
Well, it's a little bit of both.
Yeah. You know, it strikes me as stunning how conspiracy theories can be built up, and they just seem to come out of nowhere. The latest one I've been hearing about on the internet, and actually at some more respectable news agencies, is what they're calling Sandy Hook truthers, which just strikes me as really, really bizarre. I mean, how can you deny the existence of something that is so patently, obviously, this actually happened? But there are a number of people out there who are claiming that this was a black flag sort of operation, all intended to discredit the gun owners and that sort of thing. One person who I thought had a good take on this was Robert Goldberg, who's at the University of Utah historian. And he kind of said, you know, in the old days, one of the biggest problems that these sort of theorists had was to get their message out there. But now with the internet, everything has completely changed. I mean, now you can be a nobody in Bohokin, Wisconsin, and everyone in the world can literally see what you have as this nutty idea about how chemtrails are actually government plans to poison. I mean, and like I say, it's just not the nutters that are in this. I mean, I was stunned to see Alex Jones on CNN just a couple of weeks ago talking about, you know, gun rights and gun liberations. And I mean, true to form, Alex Jones went over the top because he's that kind of a person. But there's the English journalist, in quotes, who came over to America, Piers Morgan, interviewed him on that, gave him a big stage on which to spout his nutty conspiracy theories. A lot of this, you know, I mean, it's not unique. You know, there are a lot of other conspiracy theories that go out there. Again, a lot of them based on the sort of the anti-government. This one, though, the Sandy Hook one, I thought was just an incredible example of how bad thinking, ideological thinking, can cloud your mind. There's a number of videos out there, and I'm not going to mention any of them because I don't really want to promote their particular their mindset. But this one claimed to have absolute proof that the shooting was fake. There's this photo where one of the quote alleged victims is in a family photo, and she's wearing a black and red dress. So the conspiracists say that, you know, when the family had their photo taken later with Obama, you see this girl quote in the same dress. How could this be? If she was shot, you know, she shouldn't be in the photo op. So how this obviously proves that must be proof that this is faked. And again, I took a look at this sort of obvious truth, and there's this obligatory YouTube video online and such, as you can check it all out. But I was stunned at the cognitive dissonance needed to make this claim. The proof is, as I say, there's a photo of Obama visiting Sandy Brook School after the shooting. The conspiracy, again, turned that they have this alleged shooting fatality. If she's dead, the massacre couldn't have happened. It obviously is part of Obama's plan, anti-American, anti-gun agenda. Now, if you look at the actual incident itself, first of all, take note that the person who died is the oldest of a family of three. Often in families, clothing get passed down, right? So the fact that another one of the siblings may have had a dress like that, it may have been the same dress, just a different sibling. Also, if you look at the, quote, old photo, two of the sisters are wearing the same dress. So again, maybe they all had the dress and this was not particular to her. But most glaring of all is that, you know, where where it's stated in the video that the producer somehow forgot that the dead girl wasn't supposed to be in this photo, which again, I mean, if you're going to go to this kind of a conspiracy level, you're not going to forget to keep the dead girl out of the photo. But they actually say essentially that, you know, the photo, you know, so there's the dead girl, there's the father, the president, the sister, and the mom. Now, of course, people aren't in my mind, so you probably missed a little bit there, but they said there were two girls, and it's a family of three. So one of them is missing. I wonder where she could be. Obviously, she's the victim, and that's... But, I mean, how could they think this without going through all this? I mean, it seems that many people are taking this on board. If you can believe that Obama's Kenyan 9/11 was inside job, Muslims are taking over America with Sharia law, well, a fake school shooting is somehow, you know, plausible if you have your socialist, fascist Obama trying to get rid of guns in America. Anyhow... It's a nutty conspiracy theory, and I'm so embarrassed that a human would come up with it.
Well, you know, it's funny. I was recently looking into the Manhattan Project for other reasons, and what struck me about that. No, but what struck me about that though was how they had separated every development of that project. So if you were building casing, you didn't know that you were building casing for a bomb. You didn't know what you were building. All you knew is you had this kind of casing thing. It's like, okay, well, whatever. There was maybe like five or six people who knew the entire project. Truman didn't know about it until after he became president. You know, the idea that they would just like forget that they have this conspiracy theory is like, oh, geez, no one will notice. You know, like it's, there's this disconnect between, I hesitate to say reality. It's a disconnect between how secrets work, you know, the idea that you can sort of, you know, sleuth this out through blurry photos on YouTube and destruct this like massive conspiracy is just like, no, it's not how this works.
Well, and again, I mean, like, you have to be so blind to all the obvious things. As I say, you know, girl in black and red dress, the only girl in the universe that wears a black and red dress is this one that was shot and she somehow miraculously came back to life.
Yeah.
All the other evidence that points to alternatives and far, far, far more plausible answers.
Yeah.
Just written off, just boom, doesn't exist.
Let's move on to some more reasonable science and skepticism.
You know, there is hope. I mean, obviously, you know, humanity's had it shot on the planet. We've proven to be woefully inadequate, and it's probably best if we just, you know, become extinct. But then you say, Ethan, what about all this great technology and stuff that we have? I mean, even if we can't handle it, it seems to be a waste just to throw it away. So we should try and create something new to replace it, or something old that will be new again, like the Neanderthals. Okay, so I came across this imaginary ad. Single Neanderthal male seeks open, adventurous human female with the aim of procreation. If interested, please apply, yada, yada, yada. You kind of get my point. No, Ethan. Don't look at me like that. I'm not nuts. I was actually reading this week of a scientist who sort of unofficially is seeking a female host into which he plans to impregnate a Neanderthal clone. Now, of course, at first, I thought this was some glory-seeking pseudo-doctor or just a nut. But as it turns out, the scientist in question is George Church. His name doesn't ring a bell, and it didn't for me either until I did a bit of research. Turns out that he's real, which I'm sure made him happy, and not a quack or a nut. He is the director of U.S. Department of Energy Center of Bioenergy at Harvard and MIT, director of National Institute of Health Center of Excellence in the Genome Sciences at Harvard. He initiated the Personal Genome Project, and much more. So I couldn't find any kind of crazy ideas, because we've had valid scientists who had nutty ideas. So he seems to be quite legit. So first, the real science. We've decoded the Neanderthal genome, so we kind of have the big blueprint to start with. What he says is that we could take this DNA, this blueprint, and generate fresh DNA. Then, again, according to Church, we would chop it up into segments, which would be introduced into human stem cells. Now, I'm not exactly sure on how the biochemistry works in this, but apparently if you repeat this process over and over again, the stem cells would become more and more Neanderthalian and ultimately could be the source material for creating a clone. Now, Church claims that his lab can already sort of do this process, not with Neanderthal DNA, but this sort of repopulating stem cell DNA with other DNA. Now, cloning, you may or may not know, is actually far more popular than people think, or far more common. It's done quite often in agriculture. So pigs, cows, sheep, all you need is some source DNA and a compatible host. In the case of Neanderthal, of course, the compatible host would be a human female. Ergo, the Faux Lonely Hearts ad I started this with. And of course, oddly enough, a lot of the news agencies led with that sort of angle, for obvious reasons. I guess I did, so I can't complain too much. Of course, does this mean that Church or anyone else will be creating an army of Neanderthals? No. The interview, which was the source of this, is based on his sort of musings that he was talking about his latest book. He defends that the technology is almost here, so he does think this is plausible, but he doesn't really have any immediate plans. And even if he did have immediate plans, he kind of points out that there needs to be sort of a shift in cultural sensitivities before we would deem this ethical.
Yeah.
Ethan, you have an absence of ethics. Are you planning to? No, sorry, I don't mean that.
Well, I mean, well, some people say that I do. Anyway, well, it's interesting. I mean, this particular story has gotten a lot of play in the media, and I think actually from what the latest that I've heard is that it was sort of a misquote that was sort of taken out of context by the initial whoever ran with the story initially or something like that.
Der Spiegel.
Yeah. Anyway, I mean, it is kind of interesting from what I've seen on some of the science blogs is that they're sort of saying it's sort of like a 5 to 10 year away project. You can sort of start this, but it would take a while. And a pretty well-equipped lab to make this happen. Maybe like Craig Venter could do it, I don't know. But it actually does kind of raise some interesting ethical questions, because if you just create one Neanderthal, well, I mean, like that's going to be, woohoo, we've created a Neanderthal. Now what? We have a human, sort of human, to look after. So you might need to create maybe a couple, so you have like a family or something. But of course, you know, you got to raise these things from children.
Well, and you have to be culturally sensitive about this. So you have to raise them in their native culture's environment, which would be difficult because
we don't really know what their native culture environment would be like.
Exactly.
And of course, you know, how would you provide for them? What's going to happen when they reach, you know, the age of 18? Are we going to send them loose to get jobs? I mean, so it's definitely a tricky question, but it does raise at least a lot of thought experiments that, you know, it does, like, what would happen if we tried to sort of repopulate maybe an isolated area, or at least in the sense of bringing back extinct animal species like the woolly mammoth and such.
Well, one of the things that Church had mentioned in his interview was that, you know, I mean, we don't even necessarily need to bring back all of the Neanderthals to do this. But one of the things that recent research has done in those people who believe, and there's some evidence to support that humans and Neanderthals interbred, one of the things that we gained from them and why it was sort of a successful experiment is that it improved immunity, that our immune system became more diverse and able to handle more things, so that we may be able to reach into this population and improve, oops, I shouldn't say that, the species, with this crossing. But I think it's an important discussion to have for another reason, is I wonder how much better humanity would be suited now with nuclear power and nuclear bombs if this kind of dialogue had gone on prior to that. I mean, you mentioned the Manhattan Project was super, super secret for obvious reasons. But if it wasn't super secret, if they were sitting there saying, well, you know, we have this particular device that could wipe out a city, should we pursue this? And if we do pursue this, what kind of restrictions should we play on this? Because, and Church mentions this in his article, the science is going there. It, you know, whether we want to or not, it's going to be an inevitable, attainable feature that we can do sometime in the future. And if we start to talk about it now, we can start laying down, how do we do something like this ethically? Do we set down rules not to?
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's go to a quick here commercial break on CITR, and we'll be back after this.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Flaming Angels Boutique, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, the Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl, and the Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
In the sky, standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker.
You know, Ethan, did you read Philip Plait's 10 Ways the Earth Could Be Destroyed?
You mean Death from the Skies?
Yes.
Yes.
Sorry. Well, it was essentially 10 Ways the Earth Could Be Destroyed. I was surprised to find out that one of the methods has already, well, it's already happened.
Yeah, that's right. In some cool science news, we have 8th century Earth being hit by a gamma ray burst.
Now, I saw his documentary on the Discovery Channel.
Yes.
And from what I saw about it, the Earth was pretty much a charred, crisp ember.
Yeah.
Did we miss that?
It's not a good thing. So anyway, let's go through this chain of events here. So in 2012, researchers found evidence that our planet had been struck by a blast of radiation during the Middle Ages. Now, there was debate over what exactly could cause this. Because, you see, last year, a team of researchers found some ancient cedar trees in Japan that had an unusual high level of radioactive carbon known as carbon-14. And then in the Antarctic, they found unusual levels of beryllium-10 in the ice. These isotopes are created when intense radiation hits the atoms in the upper atmosphere, which suggests that a blast of energy had once hit our planet from space. And then they used tree rings, the wonderful tree rings, and ice core data. They were able to pinpoint that this would have occurred between the years of 774 and 775. But what exactly caused this was a puzzle. So there's a couple possibilities that they kind of went through. One was that a supernova, an exploding star, but that was ruled out because the debris of that event would still be visible in telescopes today, and we couldn't find one. Another team of U.S. Physicists suggested that there was an unusually large solar flare from the sun. However, controversially, some scientists thought that, well, that wouldn't have produced the same level of carbon-14 and beryllium-10 that was found. So some German researchers have offered up another explanation, a massive explosion that took place within the Milky Way galaxy. Professor Ralph Norheiser from the Institute of Astrophysics at the University of Jena said, quote, "We looked in the spectra of short gamma ray bursts to estimate whether this would be consistent with the production rate of carbon-14 and beryllium-10 that we observed, and we found what is fully consistent. These enormous emissions of energy occur when black holes, neutron stars, or white dwarfs collide. The galactic mergers only take a few seconds, and then they send out a vast wave of radiation." So again, our professor Neuhauser said, "Gamma ray bursts are very, very explosive and energetic events. And so we considered from the energy that would be, that we got, how distant they would be where it happened. So the conclusion was that it was about 3,000 to 12,000 light years away, so, you know, within the Milky Way. And although this sounds really dramatic, our medieval ancestors were probably saved from this for the simple fact that they didn't have any technology at the time. If we got hit by a gamma ray today, it would probably wipe out all our satellites. And if it was really powerful in a direct hit, it would basically give wherever it hit on the planet a lethal dose of radiation and then burn away the ozone layer. So if you weren't immediately radiated, you would die slowly from exposure from other radiation."
Yay.
Yeah, so it's not fun. But it's actually a really cool event. And, I mean, we hope it doesn't happen, of course. But at the same time, it's like, wow, the universe is awesome and deadly.
Well, you know, it could be one of those things, too, like the Tunguska event, right? That, you know, maybe it was as horrible as I saw in the video or whatever, but it hit the middle of Siberia where there was no one at the time and there's no record of it. Actually, you know, I wanted to go back and I wanted to check out my history to find out. Maybe, you know, that was the beginning of the Black Plague. You know, there's some mutations or there was some horrible famine or something like that. And I could discover nothing for like almost like a decade or two afterwards. And then it struck me. In my conspiracy mind, what it had done is it had pacified the entire planet. So nothing exciting at all really happened for like 20 years. Well, Charlemagne, but you know,
it's pretty boring, really. Yeah. Very average. The fortunate thing is that gamma ray bursts are fairly rare. They're thought to happen most, you know, 10,000 years per galaxy, and so I mean, like, you know, we're probably not going to see one in our lifetimes, or even maybe the Earth's lifetime.
Well, and there's even those things, too, that if it is as bad as it could be, as Ethan kind of implied, there's no way we can protect against it, really. There's no way we can stop it. If it's going to hit us, it's going to hit us. Until we develop the technology to move Mars in the way so it can act as an umbrella.
Well, I mean, the only thing that would... If it was far enough away, though, like if it was... You know, I don't know the estimates, but if it was far enough away, it might just like knock out satellites. I guess it would have to be, you know, reasonably close, reasonably in relative terms, of course, to destroy life on Earth. But I guess that level of distance is also going to depend on how powerful it is, how big the objects are that are colliding. So it's hard to say, really.
That's why they're bringing back the Neanderthals, because they could survive it.
Really?
No.
Okay.
So. We've been promising this for months, for weeks, for years, for centuries. The Doha of Doha. One of the underreported stories of 2012 was the Doha Climate Change Conference. It was hoped, at least by the overly optimistic, that there would be a replacement for the Kyoto Climate Agreement that expired at the end of last year. What did happen was a punt down the road until 2015. The Kyoto Protocols, the first ever to mandate reductions in greenhouse gas emissions by signatory nations, had some success and some failures. The biggest failure, of course, was Canada, with the Harper government's decision to withdraw from the protocols, once again putting short-term corporate interests above long-term national good goals. Sorry about my political speech. In the end, the 31 remaining compliant nations claimed a victory by surpassing their goal. The original intent was to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 4% below 1990 levels. They claimed that they had reached actually 16%. Sounds great, no? Well, symbolically, yes, and credit where credit is due. Much of Europe, where the majority of the reductions have occurred, has made great advances in green energy production. That said, the lion's share of reductions were not, strictly speaking, energy production in these countries, but industry via manufacturing. The greatest reductions came from Eastern Europe, where the collapse of the Soviet Union led to a precipitous collapse in industry. So regardless of Kyoto, those reductions were likely to have happened anywhere. Anyway, those of Western Europe can largely be chalked up to the massive relocation of production from the West to China et al. The massive outsourcing that occurred in the last 20 years has had a positive result in the West in helping to reduce our carbon footprint in places like Germany, where political efforts combined with capitalistic opportunism led to a real reduction, while in places like US and Canada, where devastating offshoring has also occurred, we have quickly replaced those sort of credits by increasing resource extraction. Think of the tar sands. Another huge fail of Kyoto was not to include the developing nations. As the West outsourced production to places like China, places not under the Kyoto obligations, even in theory, these places saw their carbon footprint increase exponentially. So some numbers. Canada was committed to cutting its greenhouse emissions to 6% below 1990 levels by last year. But in 1909, we were actually 33% higher than our 1999 numbers. The U.S. indicated that it would cut 7%. Currently, they are 26% over their levels. The United Kingdom committed to a 12% reduction, and they actually achieved a minus 25%, so they did good. Germany's numbers were 21%, and they achieved 24%, so they actually did good as well. China, though, on the other hand, has had a 170% increase since 2000. Okay, so that was Kyoto. Now we have Doha arrangement. First thing that was agreed to was to continue the Kyoto Protocol targets until 2020. Although this time around, the signatory nations only account for about 13% of global emissions, whereas originally it was about 60%. The negotiation track created in 2007, called the Long-Term Cooperative Action, that produced the Copenhagen Accords, the Cancun Agreement, which included voluntary commitments over 80% of the world, were finished, wrapped up, so they no longer in. The Durban Platform for Enhanced Action, designed to conclude a new treaty in 2015, which is supposed to take effect in 2020, it aims to be applicable to all parties, covering 100% of global emissions, and it took its step forward. So that is one thing that is going on and kind of positive. Now, the final text reflects the need to, quote, raise the level of ambition based on IPCC's fifth assessment report. Now, that's the it's the UN's report on how our climate is doing. It says no parties have really stepped up to the plate and offered to increase their ambitions this decade. Rather, some are seeming willing only to demand that other parties increase their emission reductions. A submission to the Doha summit during the first week of the meeting by Bolivia, China, India, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and a handful of other countries demanded that we reduce the aggregate emissions by 40 to 50% below 2020 level, 1990 levels.
By 2020.
Yes, thank you. Now, this may seem extreme and likely motivated by political jockeying, but the fact remains that these are actually lower than what's required. I did some research, and most of the climate models show that if greenhouse gas emissions are not reduced by as much as 85% below the 1990 levels, it's like game over. It's important that what we are talking about is emissions and not actual concentration in the atmosphere. These negotiations are only talking about reducing the speed that we're increasing global warming. The gases in the atmosphere are going to be there for generations. That means temperatures are going to continue to rise and rise even faster until we do some radical cuts. One of the biggest problems with the whole idea of climate change treaty is that the crisis is rapid, and it's the solutions seem to be all long-term, or we're looking at long-term. And we're short-term people. It's a very bad mismatch from our political environment, which is, again, slow, short-term, mm-hmm. versus the requirements that we need to do, which is quick and long-term thinking. I hope you got your air conditioning.
Well, you know, it's funny. I have to wonder, at what point do we need to stop having conferences where we discuss these solutions and start talking about what technology can we invent to save us? I mean, like, you know, this is actually something that kind of bugged me. A couple of years ago, I was listening to a lot of skeptics podcasts, and I don't want to name names, but a particular skeptical doctor on a Skeptic Guiding to the Universe podcast made a remark that, you know, well, you know, technology is advancing so fast, you know, this isn't really a big deal. And I sort of like, dude, really? But anyway, it seems like we kind of need like atmospheric scrubbing devices or something, because time is sort of running out on this one.
Well, you know, and the funny thing is, I mean, the climate change sort of deniers are running to the bullfight facts. It's smacking us now in the head. I mean, the number of higher than average temperatures versus the number of lower average temperatures has increased dramatically. In the past, it was like 50-50, right? So for every record high, you'd have a record low somewhere, right? But now it's like a ratio of 5 to 1, right? Australia has a temperature map that they use for the country, and they had to add 2 new colors because the temperatures were higher than they've ever been ever in the history of that. And they're suffering through like one of the longest and most severe droughts. The United States is suffering through one of the longest, most severe droughts. I mean, the evidence that it's there and that it has an impact. I mean, it's not like, oh, well, it'll be a couple of degrees warmer here. Won't that be nice? I'll be able to go out earlier in May. It's not like that. They're severe. And you're right. I mean, one of the things that has sort of prevented the idea of a technological fix to it is a lot of the environmentalists, not only the climate change deniers, but the environmentalist people, didn't want to go down that road because they say, well, if we think we can fix it with technology, then we're not going to actually try and solve the problem. We'll just put this technological Band-Aid on it. Mm-hmm. And I must admit, if this was the 80s, that might have been a viable thinking. But right now, we have a house on fire, and someone say, well, no, you need to teach them not to play with matches. It's like, no, we need to get a bucket of water onto the house. It's burning down.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's go to another quick commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back after this.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
That's one small step for man.
So vote.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
Subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So, Don, you may have heard of this fellow named Lance Armstrong.
Did he go on the moon?
No, but you see, Lance Armstrong was a cyclist.
Oh.
And he apparently won some awards or something. I don't know. Anyway, so this guy, unfortunately, though, has just brought so much shame on his family name. His ancestors, Neil and Louis, must be just spinning in their graves.
Wait a minute. I'll stop you there, Ethan. You, nor I prior to my research, may not be aware, but Lance even faked his name, kind of. He's not actually Armstrong by birth, but by marriage. His stepfather was Armstrong. Lance's biological father was Gunderson, who was Norwegian by ancestry. So, you know, famous people like Neil Armstrong, Louis Armstrong, I think there's someone who's a baseball player named Armstrong, I'm sure there's lots. They needn't feel any shame about what may or may not be talked about today, because I'm pretty sure we're not talking about Lance Armstrong's ancestry, are we?
No, although maybe on a future show. So, basically, we're talking about Armstrong. As everyone knows, he's in the news. We're going to talk about it from a couple different angles. So, recently, after decades of denying allegations of cheating, Armstrong finally admitted to decades of cheating on a special interview with Oprah recently. So as skeptics, I think we can look at this from two perspectives. The first is sort of the rationality behind doping rules, performance-enhancing drugs, and sort of the philosophy of the concept of fair play. So to start off with some science and some facts, there are several different kinds of, quote, performance-enhancing drugs. And we've actually discussed this before when we were talking about the London Olympics. But to quickly recap, we have things like anabolic steroids. These are the drugs that mimic the effects of testosterone in the body. They come with a whole host of side effects, including some pretty dangerous ones. They're banned by most sporting leagues in the world. There's the human growth hormones, which are supposed to grow muscle mass, although there's very limited scientific evidence they actually do anything. And there's blood doping, which is, this is the sort of main one that Lance Armstrong has been involved in. This is to boost the number of red blood cells in the body, giving the athlete more oxygen and endurance. And this can be done with either transfusions or the drug EPO. So the question is, do these substances give an unfair advantage to athletes who take them? The science seems to be unable to give us a satisfactory answer. Given that most of these are illegal, it's really hard to do any kind of long-term controlled studies to see what the effects are. It is apparent, however, from the amount of athletes who are using the drugs that many believe them to be giving them a significant advantage. That's hard to pin down as well, because, I mean, there are athletes who probably wear power balance bracelets, for goodness sakes.
Actually, and there is research done that the placebo effect is actually a major factor in a lot of professional sports.
Oh, yes, absolutely. So last time we talked about doping, we pondered over the difference between, say, taking drugs to get an advantage and having an advantage from some other source, perhaps, you know, if you have access to better trainers and equipment, that sort of thing. So I would argue that sporting leagues at some point have to draw a line between, or, well, defining what cheating is. Now, admittedly, it's going to be an arbitrary line because there's no objective form of cheating, of course. But we need to, at some point, figure out what's going to be allowed and what isn't going to be allowed. And I think that drawing that line at performance-enhancing drugs is a pretty good place to put it. Because, I mean, even if we assume, for instance, that they're not terribly effective, but I think that we know, for example, that blood doping is probably one of the more effective forms. Giving you that oxygen boost is a pretty big advantage. So I think drawing that line at drugs is a pretty good place to start for a couple of reasons. One, I think most of these drugs are already illegal in most countries. In fact, the U.S. has pretty strict rules on possession of these drugs without a prescription. So it's not really fair for U.S. athletes if, Canadians are able to take these pills that would get an American thrown in jail for 10 years, even having them on their person. Another reason would be health risks. We know that sports are dangerous activities. And in fact, we're finding out pretty recently that they could even be deadly. Head injuries in hockey and football, for instance, have really shown us that there are some pretty long-term and frightening results from repeated concussions. Nevertheless, having athletes secretly injecting drugs in locker rooms is really not any kind of better situation. The pressure for athletes to dope up to compete could lead them to take the wrong kind of performance-enhancing drug, or it could lead them to take something that's going to be really bad for them. There are a lot of health risks for many of these drugs. And because they're illegal, they're going to be less inclined to get help for it, which is something that we talked to Dr. Thomas Kerr about, that if it's illegal, you're less likely to seek out medical attention. Now, another reason, and this goes to sort of creating that, quote, level playing field. Most sports leagues have kind of equal footing when it comes to training. So, for example, the Vancouver Canucks don't really have an advantage over, say, the Detroit Red Wings when it comes to trainers or equipment. I mean, both teams are going to have very large budgets for that kind of thing. Their athletes are going to be able to get training year-round in the summer during the league. They're going to have access to some really good doctors, that kind of thing. In some cases, very proactive doctors, as we learned about the Calgary Flames. Now, this is the exception to this, of course, is the Olympics, because athletes are supposed to be amateurs in the Olympics. Well, supposed to be. They're not really anymore. And they don't really have access to these resources. And I think one of the most stark examples was in the London Games. I think the gold medal, the women's gold medal weightlifter was living like below the poverty line or something in America. So some countries throw significant resources at training Olympic athletes, some countries don't. So that creates a really uneven playing field, so athletes feel inclined to take performance-enhancing drugs. And also, which was pointed out to me earlier, that wealth disadvantage also works for performance-enhancing drugs, because you have wealthier athletes that can afford performance-enhancing drugs versus athletes who can't. So that's why I think that drawing that line in the sand, saying, okay, listen, we're gonna let you throw as much money as you want training yourself, but as soon as you start crossing over that line into illegal substances, we're going to kick you out.
So, Ethan?
Yeah.
And our audience members, you like a little fire, so I'm going to throw in a little fire here. You hypocrite, you. No. So there are some things in here that I think I would take, I don't know if exception with, but... So first of all, the fact that some of these drugs are illegal are not necessarily illegal for any necessary health reasons, right? They're illegal because, as you say, they are deemed to be unfair. So that's kind of a circular logic there, that a number of these drugs, if we said it was okay to dope in sports, would not be illegal in themselves.
Yeah, and that's a fair point. I mean, the reason that things like steroids are illegal has a lot to do with sort of the social taboo of using them. But I mean, they can also be dangerous on their own.
Which leads into the second part where you talked about when Dr. Carr was in here, that one of the things that makes drug use in the sense of heroin and all that dangerous is the fact that A, it's illegal, and B, these people are sort of self-medicating. They don't have health professionals to help you. Whereas if we took drug doping out of the closet, out from the shadows, that where, you know, you didn't have to do it in secret in your locker room, but you actually had a trained physician and you were doing it with the trained physician to make sure that you not only got a benefit from it, but you didn't sacrifice your health at the same time, I think that would alleviate your number two criticism with regards to that.
Well, what I would say to that, I agree. Like, if you had someone there who could advise the athletes, I think the best way out of that would be basically to have a policy in sporting leagues is that if you do take performance-enhancing drugs that are against the rules, and you go to your team doctor or whoever and say, listen, I've been taking these drugs, have a blanket policy of saying, okay, well, everybody makes mistakes, so we're not going to punish you. We're not even going to publicize it. The league will know, but no one else will. And we're going to, you know, show you how to not take them and et cetera, and how to do it safely. So basically, and this is something that I've actually heard a couple times before, Michael Shermer, who is an avid cyclist, has talked about how to get rid of doping is to basically say, okay, everyone who's done it now, we're not going to punish you. It's the only way to sort of bring it out of the woodwork, so to speak, to get people to talk about it. So I think that you can have an open policy on it without making it not against the rules.
So, but again, it still seems, as you point out, arbitrary, but I think unnecessarily arbitrary to have banned them. And this goes into your third part. And on this, I think I'm going to say yes and no is one of my favorite lines to say.
Mm-hmm.
So with regards to the Olympic athletes or that sort of thing, I think it's much easier to make this arbitrary line in the sand that we need to have something fair and balanced. Although that being said, as you just said, that's actually an impossibility because not only do you have the idea of drug enhancements, you have training enhancements, lifestyle enhancements, those sort of things. And oddly enough, I think if the Olympics wanted to do that, they would sort of supply all of the wear for all, and then athletes would sort of apply to use this facilities, and then you'd actually have sort of your level playing field. But the other part of it is, in your example, you use the Canucks. And we were talking a little before the show that things like professional sports is actually entertainment. It's not really sports. Sports is the excuse. But it's really entertainment. At which point, the more entertainment, the more better, if you know what I mean. I mean, as long as, again, there has to be factors about health and that idea. So I'm not saying, you know, we should allow athletes to shoot up with PCB before a game because that'll make for a more exciting game. That's taking it. So we're assuming that these are performance-enhancing drugs that under medical conditions seem to be safe and that this is a sporting entertainment sort of event. And as you point out, they'd all more or less be able to apply equally because they're all rich people or have access to the same sort of facilities. I don't see why that would be an unlevel playing field.
Well, I'm actually going to get to that point in our next section. So now we're going to get a bit philosophical here discussing Armstrong. So he cheated. What does that mean for our perception of fair play and honesty? Well, let's look at some of the context here because this is obviously a special case. Not only was Armstrong put on a pedestal for his achievements of being a top athlete and after a battle with cancer, he was sort of the poster boy for hard work paying off, et cetera, et cetera.
Thanks, Nike.
Mm-hmm. Now, over the course of his career, Armstrong was actually, in reality, kind of a jerk. He took millions in endorsements and charity. He would sue newspapers and journalists that accused him of doping, which we know he was lying about. And he would also bully his teammates into doping, or he would have them thrown off the team.
And it's important to note, especially with the suing journalists and all that, he just didn't sue them. I mean, he went after them.
Oh, yeah.
Like a pit bull to a raw steak. I mean, he was vicious and violent, and I mean, it was. This is where he's more than just a bad person.
He's gonna get it because I mean, I was just reading an article. I think the Daily Mail in the UK. He sued them for about £1 million. Now they're coming back at him, and they want all of it back plus £100,000 in interest. I mean, and the thing is too, like the sad aspect of this is that he would donate a lot of this money to his charity. So now you're in the position of revoking money from a cancer charity, which I think, I mean, it's just kind of a terrible situation. And it's, you know, really stupid that he did this. So anyway, we can say his actions are quite despicable. And this leads to the question of why do we feel this way? You know, we don't seem to like cheaters is the easy answer. You know, if you're playing a board game with somebody and you found out someone was cheating, you're likely going to be annoyed and you don't want to play with them. This concept of competition is that it's a structure with a set of guidelines that everyone adheres to, and that breaking these guidelines spoils the competition. And you can even apply this to things like academics. If you look at a course as a competition, the final exam is, you know, your guidelines. You have, you know, no phones, no leaving the room, no books and such. And if you're doing your final exam and you look over and you see someone with an iPad and a list of books and sources and stuff like that, and they get an A+ and you get a C, you're going to be rather annoyed by this.
But, well, what if you got an A+? What if they got an A+ and you got an A? Would that, I mean, so that okay, we'll skip that part. There is an interesting evolutionary psychological reason that we don't like the idea of cheating, is that if you are in a social community group and everyone is expected to carry their weight to do some task for the group, let's say fight a battle to defend yourself against the bad guys over the hill, and I'm fighting, risking my life, and I find out Ethan here is hiding behind a rock, he's sort of cheating. Well, that kind of makes him a detriment to our community, and there's a very strong social pressure to make sure that everyone follows the same rules. Ironically enough, of course, we have the same evolutionary pressure pushing against that, because Ethan, I shouldn't make you sound like a coward, but you're actually a genius, because by hiding behind the rock, you're less likely to die, which means your genes are much more likely to continue. So we have this bi-directional sort of push where, as a society, we want everyone to be on the same playing field, but as an individual, we all sort of have this urge to cheat because that is to our own personal advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the context of gaming, though, and again, like I say, there's sort of the two levels here. If you're dealing with the Olympics, I think there's a much more stronger sense that that you want to have this sense of fair play, even though, again, I think it's an impossibility to achieve, but we'll go with the illusion. But when you go with sport attainment, I don't quite see why it needs to seem to be as fair as you necessarily mean, as long as it's entertaining. I mean, everyone goes into it, they know what's going on, and they still enjoy it. I mean, you watch a movie about where, you know, the bad guy gets killed in the end, you're not annoyed that the whole movie was against the bad guy. You're like, well, this was a fun movie, I'm glad I watched it. And even with the sports teams, if they're all doping, it's still a level, it's a raised level playing field, or lowered, I guess, depending on your ethical stance, but it still has that, they're not cheating, right?
Because, I mean,
if everyone's following the same rules, and a part of that rule is you're allowed to take performance-enhancing drugs, then I don't see where it is an unfair playing field. Again, I think the Olympics is a different kind of case, but for professional sports, if all the teams and all the players are allowed to take performance-enhancing drugs, that strikes me as still a level playing field.
Well, assuming, though, that they are legal and that people want to use them. See, the thing is, there is this idea that, you know, if someone is going to be doing sports, whether it's baseball or hockey or something like that, we expect to see extraordinary levels of athleticism. So, you know, it's not good enough to see a Wayne Gretzky or someone score 500 goals. We want to see 1,000 goals. And, you know, it's not good enough to have someone win the home run derby. We want to see them smash the records every time. So I think the flaw behind this thinking is that it's not in an isolated vacuum. Because if you look at the NHL, for example, it's not just the NHL. It's also the AHL, which is the farm league. And then you have the junior hockey league under that. And then you have, you know, kids playing hockey under that. And then you also, of course, have international competition. So if the NHL allows doping and the European Hockey League doesn't, basically it's wiped out international play, because you can't have the two leagues work this out. If you want to have a uniform, that's why I say it has to be a uniform arbitrary system in place so that every league follows the same set of rules.
Yeah, but again, I'm going to go back to the Olympics, and you're more a sports person than me, so maybe I'm wrong in this idea. But one of the recent, quote, innovations of the Olympics was to allow professional players to play on Olympic teams. So when you have the Canadian Olympic hockey team, there are NHL players on that hockey team, which really seems to be unfair for the Kenyan hockey team, who obviously probably doesn't have as many NHL players on it.
Not as many, no.
Right. So, but at the same time, though, I mean, this is still seemed to be a level playing field in the context that it's allowed.
Well, I don't think it's quite the same. I mean, like, it's sort of, you know, you could look at Usain Bolt, the fastest guy in the world type thing. Can anyone name any of the other, like, six guys who were in that race? It's like, you only remember the guy who won. And likewise, I think that that sort of factors in. It's not a question with the Olympics of, you know, universal fair play. Everyone knew going into that race that Usain Bolt was going to win. It wasn't like, you know, the guy from France was going to beat him.
No, no, but just to make sure, there are differences amongst, I mean, you use your European, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, the American Hockey League, or the hockey rinks that we use here, are of different dimensions than what they use in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's an unfair advantage, however, whichever way you want to play that. I mean, if we're in Europe, I guess the Europeans have the advantage, because they, I think it's a bigger rink. And, right?
It's a bigger rink in Europe, and it's a smaller rink in North America, yeah.
So again, I think you have a stronger argument with the idea that, you know, do we want to have a society that is medicating children into this sort of sports line? But then I would go back, and I mean, I think one of the things I remember, the American Olympics they had in, oh, the big one in the 80s, 84 Olympics, which was in someplace. Anyhow, one of the people there had won the ice rink or whatever, and they had this big thing about how, you know, since she was like 6 years old, 6 a.m. in the morning, 5 a.m., dad would get up and they'd drive her to the rink and she'd skate. Well, that strikes me as a horrible thing to do to a child. I mean,
well, unless they enjoy it.
Well, but do they? I mean, does a six-year-old child naturally have the urge to skate 3 hours every morning, every day?
Well,
or is there like, well, you know, you like skating. Do you want to be good? Well, let's go get you onto this program.
Well, I mean, there's a certain extent of that. I mean, like, you can look at someone like Wayne Gretzky, who was practically born on the ice. I mean, a lot of people who play, a lot of the kids who play professional sports usually do so because they like it and they don't want to stop. I mean, that was my experience with it, at least. The kids who don't enjoy it usually, you know, don't play very well and they don't stick with it.
Well,
so
you get the example, and again, I hate to fall into stereotypes here, the Chinese gymnastic team or whatever. I mean, if I remember correctly, the last Olympics, there was lots of sort of stories going around that these were not kids who really wanted to do this, but they were picked up and then they were put into this stream. And even if they kind of wanted to do with it, there's a lot of brainwashing going on that this is what you want to do. So my point is that, I mean, the fact that we push a lot of this stuff on children at a very young age, that in itself can be seen as a negative. And I agree, I don't think we should be doping up kids when they're like 10 years old, but I don't think we should be making them run 5 hours every morning because of the same ideal that you're going for.
Well, I think that's a separate argument, though. Like, I don't think we can excuse one type of bad behavior with another. I think that we have to figure out what is the best course of action for the whole system. And I think that taking a sort of prohibitionist stance with doping is probably one of the better options for the whole
thing. And I will not disagree with you on that. But, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, fighting in junior leagues is banned, right? I mean, you're not
most of them.
When
yeah.
You're in the, when you're in the
well,
junior
you're a little kid, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, it's even if in the like not like if you're 15 years old or whatever. Even
I think
there,
it comes in like around 18 or something.
Right. So, but I mean, fighting in professional hockey happens all the time, and it's considered to be part of the strategy of hockey. I mean,
well,
at least it was in my day.
It was, yeah.
Right.
It's banned in pretty much every other league too.
Okay, but the idea is, though, is that you have the professionals doing one thing,
mm-hmm.
but the amateurs aren't allowed. So the professionals couldn't be taking drugs because they made it to that level.
Well, that actually goes into sort of what we were talking about. We're almost out of time, but quickly, about sports injuries. The way that we're changing our perception about, like, concussions. And you look at how, you know, it wasn't that long ago that hockey players didn't wear helmets. You know, you would see Bobby Orr or somebody without a helmet on. You think nowadays that's crazy. But that was one of the things. And you look at how we've changed our perception of young people playing sports. And ironically, one of the more interesting things I heard about this was, I think on an episode of Penn & Teller, they were talking about injuries in football, comparing it to, like, I don't know, other injuries. And it is quite brutal. And I think that we're changing our perception of what is what we're willing to tolerate for kids and what we're willing to tolerate for, you know, grown adults. And it is a pretty interesting argument about, you know, the new regulations that we're seeing happening at the grassroots level for kids and how it's working its way up the ladder. I mean, you're getting this kind of the old guard in the NHL who don't want to wear visors and they don't want to wear neck guards. And you have a generation of kids who have been said, no, you're wearing visors and you're wearing neck guards, well, either you want to or not. And as they come into the league, it's changing the perception of you know, sort of tough guy machoism into more sort of like, no, I kind of want to use my eyes when I'm like, you know, 45 years old.
You're not saying ethics are evolving.
They might be.
So Ethan, I have a confession.
Yeah.
Before the show, I took a performance enhancing drug. I took caffeine, which stimulates the brain. So I don't think we've had a fair playing field on the show.
Next time you can take some more caffeine and we'll level things out a bit. So we're pretty much out of time here on Radio Free Thinker. So let's go to our skeptical highlights.
I have two this week. Both of them sort of discussions. So one is titled, Arab Awakening, But Are We Hearing the Truth? Veteran Middle East journalist Robert Fisk has seen it all in his 30 years of international journalism. Yet perhaps nothing could compare to the upheaval of the Middle East which began in 2011, what some have been terming the Arab Spring. You can join Frisk as he talks about his reporting from this epicenter of the tension and his honest and insightful perspective on these events. This happens Saturday, February 2nd at 7 p.m. at the Goldcorp Center for the Arts. Goldcorp, really? Corporate salon. Tickets are $15, $10 for students. Another interesting discussion is Demography of the 7 Billion. Where is the world's population heading? What's going to happen next? The world population is expected to peak at about 9 to 10 billion people and then slowly decline. There are multiple questions associated with this march towards population stability. How do we know when it happens? What's the timing? What are going to be the regional variations? How many old people are there going to be? Young people? What are the implications of the stability for the world environment itself? You can listen to presenter Dr. Warren C. Sanderson, professor of economics at Stony Brook University, New York, on Thursday, January 24th at 7 p.m. at Fletcher Challenge Canada room at SFU Harbor Center in Vancouver. The cost for that is free.
Okay, well, my skeptical highlights this week are on Thursday, January 31st, CFI Vancouver is hosting a special behind-the-scenes tour of the Canadian Blood Services, which is obviously very fitting considering we talked about blood doping today. So this is actually a special CFI members only event. Of course, you can become a member at any time at CFI's website. And it's a great event. It's going to be limited to about 10 people per tour, and you get to see all the cool sciencey stuff that they do to blood after they take it out of you. So it'll be fun and exciting. I encourage you to go to that. And then my next one is, I guess you could say, it's kind of a bit of a low light. And that is, it's a discussion group that's being hosted by BC's current premier, Christy Clark, all about faith and politics, which is a groan-inducing topic, but nevertheless might be of interest to secularists. It's happening Tuesday, February 5th at 5 p.m., and it's happening at the Vancouver Club, which is downtown Vancouver. You need to pre-register, and it's $15, so if you're not a member of a little party, you may buckle at that, so keep that in mind. But nevertheless, it could be of some importance.
There's one more thing just for our local radio listeners. UBC is actually having its elections right now, and one of the things is there's the vote for the renewal of the UPass. This is something I think is good. It's one of the things that I think is a very socializing, equal thing that we should support. So if you are a UBC student, I would suggest going online and casting your vote and support the UPass.
Absolutely. Well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise.